Hello, my name is John Jacob. In this thoroughly good classical music podcast, I speak to pianist Cordelia Williams, whose second album, Cascades, out on the Somm label, features a collection of short pieces by Beethoven, Schumann, and Prokofiev.
So it's a collection of miniatures, to all intents and purposes. The idea of the album is that although the pieces are miniature in form, there's a lot more in there, actually, that the content, the musical content and the sound worlds are so vibrant and so intense. I like the idea of this inverse relationship between the length of the pieces and actually what's contained in them. So all the pieces are very short, but it's as if they're just glimpses into worlds, many different worlds, and each glimpse is so vibrantly composed, so boldly expressed, that you can kind of sense an entire existence. This all started with the Beethoven Bagatelle, this opus 126. They're very, very late to Beethoven. It's pretty much the last thing he ever wrote for piano. I've been playing these for a long time. It's always kind of felt to me like the name Bagatelle technically means something, a trifle, or something that's light and doesn't have much importance. And it seems such a contrast with the actual music, because the music it's like it's condensed all his experience and all his compositional creativity and ingenuity is condensed rather than diluted.
Later on in this episode, you'll also hear Cordelia exploring a trip to Kenya, the subject of a fascinating YouTube documentary in which she talks to people like this chap, 19-year-old Kenyan pianist Teddy.
My name is Teddy Otero. I'm 19 years old. I live in Lakisawa and I play the piano.
Are you able to put into words how you feel when you play that piece?
It's a feeling like you are somehow there when Bach was composing this piece. And you're working with him, and then you forget everything that it's around the area that you are living in. Then you're somehow there with your hero, with your mentor.
The first time I became aware of your oeuvre was at the Two Moors Festival, where you played, I can't remember what the title of the concert was, but it was stuff from a new album.
I think, yeah, that was my previous album.
It was an adorable concert. It was a really, really lovely thing, because it came at a point in time when it felt, in my memory, as though concerts were just about returning.
Yeah, it was quite early, wasn't it? I can't actually remember the timeline now. But it did feel...
It was 2021.
Like it felt like... I mean, I still feel like all the concerts feel special. I don't know when that will wear off. But
so do concerts feel different from how they were before the pandemic?
I don't know if it's the pandemic result or just me, you know, getting older or appreciating concerts more. I'm not sure what's caused it. But I feel like I'm really enjoying the concert experience.
Which suggests maybe that you weren't enjoying the concert experience before.
It doesn't suggest that. It doesn't suggest that. But I suppose, I don't know, maybe I've relaxed more over the last few years. And maybe that was to do with the pandemic, or maybe it was just me growing up. I don't know.
That particular album, Nightlights, and the concert too, was a very carefully curated selection of pieces, as I recall, which was meant to sort of illustrate or accompany transition from night to dawn.
Vaguely, yes. The idea was all the different experiences that we can have at night. So it can be peaceful and beautiful. It can be lonely, but it can be a good kind of lonely, you know, solitude. Or it can be horrible, you know, nightmarish and anxiety-ridden.
I don't remember it being anxiety-ridden or nightmarish.
Well, some of the bits of the album are. So the Schubert Sonata, which is the centrepiece of that album, the C minor sonata, that is really a nightmare. And I'd say also the Mozart Fantasy in D minor is kind of like a hallucination. It's almost, I mean, it has moments of beauty and sort of remembrance, but then there's also these very dark hallucinatory sections. So the idea of the album was to bring together, weave together all these different kinds of experiences, positive and negative, and gently wend our way towards dawn, which is the Schumann Songs of Dawn. And then there's this real sense of, I don't know, light coming and arrival and hope for a new day. I love that album. I enjoyed making it.
What did you enjoy about the process?
I think it's like a puzzle. It was quite complicated to try and put the music together in a way that made sense musically. Also made sense in terms of, you know, the key progressions, how each piece moves into the next piece and those connections, but also the emotional connections between the pieces, and that it would feel like a journey where you ended up somewhere different from where you started, but then also to make sure it fitted on the CD, and also to make sure it to make sure it was well balanced, you know, so that there wasn't too much of, I don't know, too much classical or too much modern or too much slow or too much loud, you know, so that it was really well balanced overall. So there was a lot to think about, and I kind of enjoyed the puzzleness of it.
And it also, it was the first time that I'd heard Peace.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, which was just, I mean, I listened to it the other day and just was transported to the Two Moors Festival. It is ravishing.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, that was, I hesitate to say one of my favourite things because I love everything on that CD, but one of my favourite discoveries in the programming was the way that the Thomas Tomkins Pavan went so perfectly with that Bill Evans. So the Evans piece is this very spacious improvisation, really, on C major. It's just got the same chordal ostinato the entire way through, and it's incredibly meditative. And the Tomkins Pavan is very intense, and it leads just perfectly into the Bill Evans. It works so well, I think. So yeah, that's also what I really enjoy about putting together a CD like that, is when you can make the little discoveries that are just great.
I heard it as being very consoling, and maybe that was possibly why it had such an impact, because at the time, hearing it at the time, and I never heard it until that concert, at the time, every concert was an emotional, highly emotional experience because we've been denied it. So it's nice to revisit that. You have a new album out, which is why we're here. It's called Cascade. I know this because it's written on the paper that I printed out in front of me. tell me about that.
Okay, where to begin? So this was quite a long time in developing, just in my head. I think I first had the idea, it would have been winter 2019. So what's that? Nearly 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. When I first thought that I would like to record the Prokofiev and the Beethoven. So I should say on the CD is Beethoven Bagatelles.
Which is why I didn't put the Beethoven or the Prokofiev on the album.
Yeah, so Beethoven Bagatelles, Prokofiev, Vision Fugitive, or Fleeting Visions, and Schumann Waldszenen, or Forest Scenes. So it's a collection of miniatures, to all intents and purposes. But I think the idea of the album is that although the pieces are miniature in form, there's a lot more in there, actually, that the content, the musical content, and the sound worlds are so vibrant and so intense. I like the idea of this inverse relationship between the length of the pieces and actually what's contained in them. So all the pieces are very short, but it's as if they're just glimpses into worlds, many different worlds. And each glimpse is so vibrantly composed, so boldly expressed, that you can kind of sense an entire existence beyond that, but you only get this tiny glimpse of it. And that to me is really fascinating. I find the idea of this passing moment, just of you glimpse something and then it's gone, I think that's amazing. And that's quite unique to music in some ways.
There's been quite a long pause since there was a break in making podcasts, which was essentially a break in talking to artists, really. And the one thing that I'm reminded of, coming back to it, is that not only does the artist have to be able to obviously play the music, but they also have to be able to talk about it in a way that makes you want to go, I want to hear that right now. Is that something that comes naturally? Or is that something that you've worked on?
I think a bit of both. I do like talking to people generally.
Great.
I guess hence me being here on this podcast.
What a relief.
So, I think I'm good at maybe putting over an idea of something that I feel passionately about. And I've also always spoken in concerts. I was doing that even from, when I was a teenager. So I suppose in that sense, it kind of comes naturally. But I have also had to work on not saying all the time, for example.
I don't really care about that, though. Yeah, is that really...
Well, I think it can get a bit grating if you do it all the time.
Well, yeah, if you don't know what you're saying and you're saying all the time, then there's a bit of an issue, but...
If you're trying to introduce a concert and there's lots of ums, well, maybe it's okay a few.
I think that's it. I think I would take issue with those members of the audience who are complaining about that, but then I'm not the person playing. When you were doing that as a teenager, my assumption is that that would have been an unusual thing in concert presentation style.
It was unusual back then, yeah. I think it's become a lot more popular now, which is really good. I love the idea that you can, in a concert, that it doesn't have to be so formal. I like some elements of the formality because I think it's like a ritual that we go through, isn't it? And it's important.
Church.
Yeah, it's important to have some of that sort of, that it feels special. But then I also think that it's nice to hear how the musician connects with the music that they're playing. I don't think it's necessary, but when I do it, people seem to really like it, so I've just kept on doing it.
When in those events where people don't do it, I now think, oh, I feel a little bit cold, as though they're not even aware that I'm there, which is a very odd thing to say, I know, but I think I've become quite accustomed to artists talking about what they're about to play, or as though it sort of heightens the experience.
But then there is also a place for just going on and playing, I think. It depends on the piece. I think sometimes a piece almost doesn't need, to say anything about it. Or it maybe depends on the atmosphere of the concert. So I try not to have a kind of a rule about it. Sometimes I speak and sometimes I don't, depending on how it feels.
I'm suddenly reminded of the other time when I saw you, which was I was walking up from the bar in Wigmore Hall at the RPS Awards, I think, and I was following you and Nicola Benedetti. I mean, that is a massive name drop, isn't it? But I think I'm right in saying that you were both giggling. Did you go to an RPS Awards with Nicola Benedetti, maybe?
That would have been.
That would have been about 2 years ago at Wigmore Hall.
I don't think that was me.
Oh, was it not? Oh, this is really embarrassing. Are you sure?
Someone
Are you sure?
Like
maybe you were up for an award and you didn't realise it. Or maybe you were drunk.
And maybe my doppelganger was there.
You completely brushed past the thing about being drunk. I'm sorry, you were talking about the album and then I completely ambushed you.
I was captivated by this idea of these tiny little moments and how much importance they can have. You know, I feel like in life as well, that often it's those tiny moments which really stick with us. And somehow almost mean the most. You know, it doesn't have to be a really important big event for it to have a lot of meaning. And that's what I feel about these pieces, that they're very concentrated. So this all started with the Beethoven Bagatelle, this Opus 126. They're very, very late Beethoven. It's pretty much the last thing he ever wrote for piano, far later than the last piano sonata. And I've been playing these for a long time, and it's always kind of felt to me like, even though they're short pieces, and the you know, the name Bagatelle technically means something, a trifle, or something that's light and doesn't have much importance. And it seems such a contrast with the actual music, because the music is, it's like it's condensed all his experience and all his compositional creativity and ingenuity is condensed rather than diluted.
Would they originally have been intended to be performed as a whole, or were they just like individual pieces that could be picked out?
I mean, I'm sure both, but I think as a whole, the reason I say that is because there's a key structure, a harmonic structure throughout the cycle, which climbs down by a third each time. So it starts in G major and then G minor, and then it goes down to E flat major, then it goes down another third to B major, then it goes down another third to G major, and then down another third to end up in E flat major. So that to me implies that they're supposed to be a cycle.
And the emotional effect of that would be, for those of us who perhaps, or for those people who wouldn't necessarily be aware of that, the emotional impact of that descending down keys is what?
I would say that you wouldn't know why, but that it sort of makes sense somehow, that there is a connection there, but it's not a standard, you know, going
darker?
To dominant for
it. I just wonder whether it becomes dark. It's not a trick question.
Yeah, I think it's almost like a settling feeling. So when we go down the third Bagatelle in E flat major, you go down from G minor to E flat major, and there's this sense of peace. So yes, maybe it is a sort of, not darkness, but like a calmness. So there are 20 of the Vision Fugitive. I think there's everything in these pieces. There's a really nice poem quote, if I can remember it.
Shall I get the page?
Oh, have you got it?
I think it might be on.
Oh, you're so well prepared.
I think it's in the liner notes.
It is. It's something like,
Vamp until ready, vamp until
every,
ready.
In every fleeting vision, I glimpse many coloured worlds, the many coloured play of rainbows or something. I glimpse worlds. Anyway.
Oh, in each fugitive vision, I see worlds full of the changing play of rainbows.
There we go. So there is definitely a conscious connection with this idea of seeing different glimpses of different worlds. And they're sort of, I think they could be worlds of the imagination or worlds, emotional worlds, or it could be like another universe where things are just completely different, that each of the pieces is so different and so vibrant. I just love them. I mean, so there's one that's marked ferocious, feroce, and they have really, some of the markings are great, you know, really unusual things. Like one of them is marked comodi, like easy, comfortable, which I've never seen as a marking before. One of them is picturesque. You know, it's just such a variety of sound worlds and atmospheres. So yeah, playing them is like, it's this kind of schizophrenic experience.
The other thing the harpsichord said to me, a harpsichordist said to me, was that I asked them if they ever listened to their own recordings, and they went, well, no, because I can play the stuff anyway, so I don't need to listen to my own recording. If I want to listen to, you know, if I want to listen to something, I'll play it. I just wonder whether you listen to your own recordings too.
Occasionally.
Wow, really paused on that one.
Yeah. So I do find that when I've made a recording, I find it hard to listen to for a good while after that, because it's been so... it's almost somehow painful to go back, because it's such an intense experience to prepare a CD and all the work that goes into it, and then the recording experience is incredibly intense. And then somehow once it's gone through the process and it's come out as a CD, I feel like I just need to leave it settle for a little while. But I'm still playing the music, so it's not that I don't want to hear the music. You know, I played them in a concert on Saturday, so, and I loved playing them. So it's not that I don't want to hear the music itself, it's more that I don't want to hear my particular, that particular interpretation that I made.
You're making it sound like drama.
Well, I wouldn't say trauma, but it's definitely a full-on experience for me, making a CD. So I think I just want to let it settle for a while, so, and then I might come back and listen to it later.
That does suggest then that if that's two people, who are two musicians who are saying the same thing, that, I mean, I said to the harpsichordist that I just thought it was very sad. Because you spent all this time working on this thing. And I don't want to have it on the mantelpiece and be going, look, I made that. I wouldn't do that.
I do feel very proud of my CDs, and sometimes I'm forced to listen to them because sometimes my husband or my children want to listen to them, and then I don't want to be a killjoy. So I will occasionally put up with it, but I think the reason
Gracious of you. If my children want to listen to it, I'm prepared to have them listen to it.
But you know why I think it sometimes feels uncomfortable to listen to? It's because, by its nature, a recording is a snapshot of my interpretation at that time. And, you know, since I made the recording, the way I play those pieces has already changed so much, just from continuing to play them in concerts and continuing to develop and think about them. So going back to listen to how they sounded or how I felt about them a year ago, when did I record it? Like 9 months ago.
21st to the 22nd of January 2023.
Okay, so what's that? Like 8 months ago?
No, it's this year.
8 months ago. It's a weird experience because that's not how I play them now. So although that is part of the thing with recording a CD, you know, of course it has to be a snapshot of how it was then. And it can't keep changing as the time goes on.
I keep changing. I'm listening to you talk and I'm also picturing you at home with your children and your husband and there being some kind of row over an album of yours.
That's actually happened. Because, my husband will say he wants to listen to so-and-so, and then I'll say, maybe I'll go in the other room.
Is he a musician?
He is not professionally a musician, but
his opinion doesn't count.
Well, I think it counts.
I'm throwing you a bone here, Cordelia.
Yes, you're trying to bait me, aren't you?
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is the film about being in Kenya, which looked like a cracking experience.
It was.
Tell me more about that. I mean, it looked like it stirred up lots of memories for me about going to other far-flung places, but that seemed like something that really meant a lot to you.
Yeah, it was very interesting. We had an opportunity during COVID times to move out to Kenya for 6 months. Very fortunate, just through my husband's work, they had an office there. So there was this opportunity and we thought, well, there's no concerts, so I'm not missing anything. And I can practice just as well there as I can here. So let's just go. So we did. And I felt like, as well as practicing and maybe giving some concerts, I thought it would be quite nice if I could try and be useful and do some teaching or something while we were there. And so I was set up with a couple of charities that work in Nairobi with music, and this led, there's a long story, but it led to me doing some masterclasses with pianists from Nairobi, and I really enjoyed working with a lot of them. There were some really special people, and I got some funding from the RPS. They had an enterprise fund. I don't know if you remember, during COVID, there was this special fund for musicians who were doing something just a bit different, get music out there in a different way. So I got some money to make a film about some of the young musicians and pianists that I was coaching and working with. And it just took on a life of its own. I loved making the film. I mean, it was totally new experience for me. I just jumped in the deep end and had no idea what I was doing at all. But I learned a lot doing it. And yeah, I met a young man during that time who kind of impressed me, who was just very determined to learn and, you know, would have done anything to learn music and to learn more about the piano. And I just liked teaching him. It was very satisfying to teach. And so after the film came out and people kind of responded really well to it, and very long story cut short is that Teddy, who's this young man, ended up going to the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire. So he's now in his second year, which is a huge, huge deal. I think he's the first Kenyan ever to study piano at the European Conservatoire, possibly even any conservatoire. I don't know about that. But it was a huge achievement for him and a quite scary thing to take advantage of. I mean, this opportunity arose and he took it, and I think it's amazing.
He seemed, in the film, he seemed very still.
Yes.
And and sort of inevitably unaffected by all of the, you know, not displaying the usual sort of signs of someone who is musically talented or what have you, you know, because he was just very everyday. He seemed very everyday in conversation with you. It was a lovely thing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. He is very still. He's got this almost slightly otherworldly quality about him. He's quite shy as a person, but I think it's really helped him because it means that he's not been afraid to just pursue his own path, which is not really an accepted thing to study the piano. I mean, I found out the other day that his parents never knew that he was learning the piano. He used to sneak off. And because it's not really... I mean, I think they're on board now, but I think
presumably, yeah.
Back then, I think it wasn't really a thing to study piano, and it wasn't, he didn't feel like they would really approve of it.
And yet my impression from the film was that there was already an established community, or you know, this wasn't a one-off. There was sort of a group of people who were studying.
Yes, the charity that I was working with, Ghetto Classics, they do amazing things. They take music into some of the quite disadvantaged areas of Nairobi, and I mean, it's really musical outreach. It's to get people involved in music at a quite, you know, sometimes a quite basic level. They have an orchestra and they try and get the young people to come in, you know, off the streets into music, and to, you know, help those young people to show themselves what they can do and to show others what they can do. That's more than often people expect of them. So that's what Ghetto Classics does, and it's amazing. I think the kind of practice and study that Teddy was wanting to do, you know, to play Chopin or to play a concerto or to go around giving concerts, that is not really on offer. So for him
to
anyone, right, really there. So for him to have pursued this studying of piano, sort of one-minded, you know, single-minded pursuit of piano knowledge, is kind of amazing and impressive.
And to do that without his parents realising.
Yeah, and without any teacher. And, you know, he didn't have any.
How did he learn then?
Just taught himself using YouTube videos. So he'd watch something and then work out how they were doing it and then just spend the time. I mean, it's really inspiring. Kind of also made me... how to say this? I think I feel like I came back from Kenya with a renewed appreciation of what an amazing thing practice is. I've always loved practicing. I've never felt like I have to chain myself to the piano. I really enjoy it. I find it fascinating to kind of make those discoveries. But even having met Teddy and some of the other people that I was working with, I felt even more like what a privilege it is to be able to spend time on music.
I always found practice to be quite meditative, so I really got into the detail. I wasn't very good, but I still really enjoyed the practice process. So I never really understood why people complained about learning scales or learning pieces, because it's all part of the joy of it.
I mean, I agree. I think it's when you make a discovery. You realise how something works or what something means in the music. That is just the best feeling. It's like almost like a drug, you know.
I have run out of questions. That makes it sound as though I've come very ill prepared. But I'm wondering whether there's anything else that you'd like to say that I haven't asked you.
Well, the only thing that's springing to my mind about Teddy is that there's going to be a Radio 4 programme in October on which we are both featured, called How to Spot Potential. So
is it all about him, or is it?
There are I think 5 episodes on different, you know, different areas. I think there's music, sport, business, education, or something like that. And his story and my story, you know.
How do you spot potential then?
Well, my answer, I mean, I don't know how they're going to put it all together with my answer and his answer and the different strands, but I felt that it was about when someone just loves music. In my experience, it was so clear to me that Teddy was someone that I would be happy to support, because he would have done anything to learn, and that is so valuable. And I suppose there's also the aspect of understanding that you're communicating something, and that sort of natural instinct for how to communicate something through music, you know, an atmosphere or a feeling, that's very hard to teach that. So to me, the fact that he had both this something like magic about the soul that's inside the music, but then also had this incredible focus, that to me was like a, you know, winning combination.
You've been listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. Follow Thoroughly Good on Twitter @ Thoroughly Good and on Instagram @ Thoroughly_Good.